This is New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire Supreme Court has been weighing the state's only death penalty conviction since last November, and yesterday it finally released its ruling in the case of Michael Addison, who shot and killed Manchester policeman Michael Briggs in 2006. The court upheld both Addison's conviction of capital murder and the constitutionality of our capital punishment law itself. Reaction around the state was sober from both death penalty opponents and supporters. Manchester Police Chief David Mara, who served with Officer Briggs, said New Hampshire's statute protects law enforcement.
If police officers are gunned down and executed and there is no repercussions other than life in prison, how are we supposed to protect the public? How is the public supposed to feel if a police officer can be killed and then he can just go to prison?
The court left only one separate question unanswered, whether Addison's sentence was disproportionate and excessive compared to other similar cases. But on every other argument raised by his defense, and there were many, the court disagreed. Now this 243-page ruling will be scrutinized by New Hampshire lawmakers as they prepare to consider a death penalty repeal bill next year. Governor Maggie Hassan said she's keeping an open mind.
I oppose the death penalty as a matter of faith and conscience. I think it is very important that before we proceed with any final decision, that everyone with an opinion or a belief in the issue is heard, and I'm going to listen very carefully to all points of view.
Today in The Exchange, we examine yesterday's ruling, what it might mean, and let's hear from you. What's your reaction to this news? Do you think it's good or bad for our state? What do you want to see happen from here on out? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. It's one word, NHPR Exchange. Our guests in the studio are Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. He's covered many a death penalty debate at the State House. Josh, thanks for taking time out. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura.
Also joining us, John Graby, professor at UNH School of Law, specializing in constitutional law. And John, thank you also for going through this big, long decision and helping us out this morning.
Thanks for inviting me.
Later on during the hour, we'll hear from political opponents of the death penalty and political supporters of the death penalty. And we'll take your calls and questions too. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, John, your reaction as a lawyer, 243 pages, how sweeping a decision is this?
It's quite sweeping. As you mentioned in your introduction, there's really only one issue left to decide on the direct appeal portion of this case. That does not mean that the case is over, as you suggested. After that final issue is decided, and on the assumption that that issue continues to uphold the constitutionality of this death sentence, we would move into the collateral review stage of this, which involves claims being made on habeas corpus, constitutional claims being reconsidered. The case will eventually make its way over to federal court because there is a right to have a federal court decide federal constitutional claims, and there are a number of federal constitutional claims that have been made in this case. So this largely concludes a very important stage of the appeal, but the legal journey is by no means over.
Interesting. So the New Hampshire State Supreme Court does not have the last say on this. A death penalty case can go through multiple levels of appeal, John? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And in fact, it will go, unless Addison waives his right, it will eventually go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow. Well, and as I said, you're a lawyer, focusing on constitutional law. 22 arguments that the defense made, 22 arguments. I'm struck, John, by the fact that the state Supreme Court said no to all of them. That's a big deal.
I am, too. And I'm struck by the fact that it was unanimous. And I'm struck by the fact that there was complete agreement with the trial judge on all 22 issues because the issues raised in this case are issues that are divisive and reasonable people feel very on both sides of the issue feel very, very strongly about. So it seems as though unanimity was a highly sought after value, and they were able to find a narrow path to unanimity with respect to the the issues raised in this appeal.
And a little bit later, John, I want to ask you about that one remaining issue that you touched on earlier, the fact or the question of whether this punishment in Mr. Addison's case is excessive and disproportionate. That's the court's words. But Josh Rogers, I want to bring you into this too. Just remind us, Josh, if you could, please. It's often said that New Hampshire's death penalty statute is narrowly drawn. Nobody's been on death row for, 70, 80 years. Just remind us what that means, Josh, please. Narrowly drawn.
Well, the only crimes eligible for the death penalty under New Hampshire law are would be the murder of an on-duty police officer or a judge, murder for hire, murder committed in connection with kidnapping, murder during rape, murder committed during certain drug offenses, and a murder committed by a convict already serving a sentence of life without parole, and a home invasion was added to that a couple of years ago in the wake of the Mount Vernon murders, home invasion, the Cates case.
Right. And what's the political argument, Josh, for this narrowly drawn statute?
Well, that it the political argument on its behalf is that, it's done its job. New Hampshire doesn't have a lot of, as you know, a lot of people ending up on death row, and that no one's been executed here since 1939. The last few years, there's been a lot of activity with both the Addison case and the John Brooks case, where it was a murder for hire, where he was potentially up for the death penalty. But the law enforcement says it provides a necessary protection. They would argue it provides a deterrent. Those on the other side disagree. Over the last decade or so, it's been, New Hampshire considered repealing the death penalty when Gene Sheen was governor back in 2000. At that time, no state had repealed the death penalty since the U.S. Supreme Court allowed it to be reinstated as an option. That was a very big deal. It passed both chambers. This was a long time ago, Pope John Paul weighed in on behalf of repeal. Gene Sheen vetoed it, citing the murders up north, Carl Draga's rampage, said so, crimes are so heinous that we need this on the books. Repeal was considered in 2009 when Democrats were riding high in the legislature, got through the House. The Senate tabled it in some measure out of sensitivities over the Addison case. And in 2011, it was expanded, as I mentioned, with Cates. And there's going to be a new push this year to repeal it. And the Catholic bishop, the Episcopal bishop, people who have been directly affected by murders are behind this. And, the political dynamic has changed a little bit. And it'll be interesting to see. They're also making a lot of fiscal issues are part of this. They're citing the great costs to taxpayers of the Addison case, for instance, which my understanding is it's at $5 million and the clock's running.
$5 million already on
yes.
this case. Yeah. So New Hampshire's kind of gone up and down on this, Josh, mostly coming close to repeal in 2000. Sort of close to repeal, though not as close in 2009, and then actually adding another crime onto the law in 2011. So we've kind of gone back and forth on this.
Well, one thing that's different now is Governor Hassan. Jean Shaheen was loud and clear that she was in favor of the death penalty statute as written, as was Governor Lynch. This last election, we had the interesting occasion of having the nominees of both major parties, Governor Hassan and Ovid LaMontagne, for Republicans, both saying they oppose the death penalty, both on moral grounds. Governor Hassan yesterday, I asked her, the tape you played was in response to a question about how involved are you going to get in this debate? Are you going to simply sign it if it arrives at your desk? Are you going to be out there on its behalf? And, she made no great claims about what she's going to do. So it'll be interesting to watch how active or not active she ends up being in this debate.
How much she puts herself out
there. Yeah,
she
said she's going to listen, which I guess is the minimum expectation of any governor in such a case.
Let me invite our listeners to join us now. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. The number 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to our listeners now. And Gillian's calling from Hudson. Hi, Gillian. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in and show my opposition to the death penalty. I think a lot of times, we were talking about the Pope and I think it's about faith for a lot of people, but I'm not religious. And, I see that this is still something that's very wrong. And, I don't want the government, state employees, having to kill someone on my behalf, on behalf of, society at large. And especially when we have this you know, we can put them in jail forever and they won't pose any threat to society. I don't understand why we would need to move forward with murdering someone because of the crime they've done.
Let me ask you a quick question, if I could, Gillian, and I'm sure you heard that piece of sound that we played from Chief Mara. As a law enforcement person, he felt law enforcement officers put themselves out there every day at incredible risk to protect our safety. So he seemed to be saying, look, law enforcement needs this extra measure of security. What do you think about that, Gillian?
I mean, I don't think when people are considering whether they're going to shoot a police officer, whether they could be getting the death penalty or not. I just don't think that's something that crosses criminals' minds when they're, you know, about to commit a crime. And, you know, even the recent case that's happening, you know, it seemed like it was a, you know, heat of the moment in the situation kind of thing and not, you know, planned out ahead of time and thinking about the consequences.
Gillian, thanks a lot for calling in. Appreciate it. And Josh Rogers, to you, you know, she said something I wanted to ask you about. She said, I don't want the government killing someone on my behalf. How prevalent a political sentiment do you think that is in New Hampshire?
Well, it's unclear. There hasn't been a great deal of polling on the death penalty. There was some polling done by UNH back in 2009, which showed that, you know, there was more GOP support for the death penalty than there was support among Democrats. That's not terribly surprising. But that poll also showed that it wasn't an issue that really was going to drive a lot of voters to do one thing or another. Ultimately, if it's time to, you know, vote for candidate X or Y, that this was going to be a crucial factor. You know, one interesting thing is, though, is that the distrust of government in general, and obviously the rise of more DNA evidence, which has exonerated people on death row, has, and, you know, just the failure of government to perform, you know, in a number of ways, you know, we don't need to go into all of them, has, you know, given rise to a skepticism about government competence. You know, particularly among Republicans, that adds a new twist to this debate. There are certainly a lot of more libertarian-leaning people in the State House that are less likely to be swayed by law enforcement arguments than have been in the past. And that's one of the things that's going to be interesting to watch as this debate unfolds.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Gillian. And we'll take more of your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be back in a minute.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Next week, Writers on a New England Stage welcomes crime novelist Patricia Cornwell. She'll be reading from her latest book, Dust, and speak with NHPR's Virginia Prescott about her writing process. Join us at the Music Hall in Portsmouth November 13th. Tickets and information are at nhpr.org. Writers on a New England Stage is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from People's United Bank, helping businesses, small and large, grow to the next level in branches and online at peoples.com. From the Bernstein Sure Affordable Care Act team, providing clients with counsel in the areas of healthcare law and the Affordable Care Act in Manchester and at bernsteinsure.com. And from Waldorf Schools of Southern New Hampshire, including High Mowing School, a boarding and day high school, offering a curriculum of arts-infused academics, highmowing.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at yesterday's state Supreme Court decision to largely uphold the capital murder conviction of Michael Addison and, more broadly, the state's death penalty law. We invite your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. One word, NHPR Exchange. Our guests in the studio are John Grabe, professor at UNH School of Law, and Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Joining us now on the phone is Rennie Cushing. He's a Democratic representative from Hampton and longtime advocate of repeal of the death penalty in New Hampshire. He'll be sponsoring a bill to repeal the death penalty again this year. And Rennie Cushing, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, what's your reaction, Rennie, to this decision yesterday?
You know, well, first of all, my heart goes out to the, you know, family of Michael Briggs. As somebody who's had my father and my brother-in-law were murdered, I know that there's a pain for which there are really no words to describe amongst survivors of murder victims, and I don't want the victim to get lost in this debate. I think that, you know, as you know, the death penalty is something that, you know, will be debated next year in the legislature. I think that there are people who've come to the conclusion that the death penalty is a, you know, it's a failed system. It doesn't meet the needs of law enforcement. It doesn't meet the needs of victims of crime, and that New Hampshire can live without the death penalty. And I think that's part of what the discussion is. I should also note that the legislation we'll consider next year is proactive. I mean, it's prospective. It really has nothing to do with, you know, the current case before the courts. That will wend its way through. And what we'll be doing is having a discussion about kind of the future and what kind of criminal justice policy we want to have.
So your bill will have nothing to do with the Michael Addison case, basically. That's a separate thing.
That's a separate thing. The bill that will, you know, it's not my bill. It's a bipartisan
sure.
bill that has a, you know, broad base of support. But it's a bill that will, you know, it'll apply to, you know, crimes that would be committed after the effective date of the bill.
Well, and
so we try not to, you know, that's lots of reasons.
Representative Cushing, as you know, I'm sure, 22 arguments made by the defense for Michael Addison, all rejected. Does that not spell good news for your effort? The court seems to be comfortable with New Hampshire's law.
Well, it's not the, you know, the legislature is the you know, makes the laws in the state of New Hampshire. I think the court was interpreting the laws that exist today. You know, it hasn't ruled on the proportionality question yet. But I think we want to, you know, here in New Hampshire, we have to, you know, make a decision about what kind of public policy we want to have going forward. And, you know, do we want to have a situation where, for instance, we send millions of dollars to pursue one case at the same time there are over 120 unsolved homicides in the case for which the state is spending, you know, very little money. And from a victim survivor perspective, it seems to me that, you know, that we should, that for every individual who's had somebody murdered, the most heinous crime is that of their loved one. And that the state has a responsibility and an obligation to all murder victims' family members to pursue justice in the case. And sometimes the death penalty ends up becoming a diversion from the real needs of victims. It becomes a diversion of the real needs of law enforcement.
Well, and yeah, as you talk about the cost, Representative Cushing, I've got an email from Arnie who says the state has already spent upwards of $5 million on the Addison case, and the state Supreme Court isn't even done. Please ask Representative Cushing if he has other ideas on ways we could spend public funds to enhance public safety, support victims' families, and bring killers to justice. So that's an email from Arnie. You're kind of touching on that, Representative Cushing, but do you want to add a little bit more?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that if you ask any police chief in the state of New Hampshire what they would like is more boots on the ground, more training, more materials. We need to put an emphasis on crime prevention. I think if you look at the needs of murder victims' families in the state, you know, we are capped out at $25,000 is the maximum a family survivor of a homicide victim can receive from the Victims' Compensation Fund to help meet kind of their emotional needs, their physical, you know, their needs, their material needs. And that's really, that says something about what our values are, that we focus so much attention on pursuing one case, and yet we do nothing for all the survivors. We do very little for all the survivors of homicide and survivors and victims of crime in general.
Okay. Well, Representative Cushing, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Blair.
That's Rennie Cushing, Democratic representative from Hampton, and as we heard, a longtime advocate for repeal of the death penalty in New Hampshire. The number for you to join us with your questions, comments, reactions to this big decision by the state Supreme Court yesterday is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word there. And John Graby, before we go back to our listeners, let's talk a little bit more about these 22 questions raised by the defense. As I said to Representative Cushing, the court rejected all of them. Is that a big deal? Does the court usually en masse reject, you know, all arguments, or do they kind of pick and choose?
Well, what's unusual here, an appeals court will typically respond to all of the arguments that are made, though, I mean, if they find some of the arguments to be frivolous, they can deal with it in just a sentence or two. What's unusual about this is that all 22 arguments, which is an enormous amount of arguments in an appeal, all of them received plenary consideration by the court, meaning they were fully vetted, they were fully explored, and that's why we have a 243-page opinion.
And that's why it took a year.
That is why it took a year. you know, ironically, some of the issues that I think are the most complex and difficult issues involving the constitutionality of the death penalty didn't get perhaps the full exploration that they might have gotten in an appeal were those issues, you know, the only issues raised. Because the court had so much work to do, the court had to deal with claims of error in the jury selection stage, in the trial stage, in the sentencing stage, and there's two stages of sentencing in a capital case. There was so much ground to cover that it's a very, very professionally written opinion, but I felt that I wanted to hear a little bit more from the court on certain issues about the constitutionality of the death penalty, especially the racial implications of the death penalty, which is, you know, which is an enormous public controversy, not only here, but nationally.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, they did rule on this, you know, piece by piece, these sort of specific issues, where the trial was held, whether the evidence presented was too emotional. Your colleague Buzz Scherr at UNH Law has called this a workmanlike decision, not necessarily these grand sweeping statements. And yet, most of the reporters who followed up on this story, here's a story from Mark Hayward of the Union Leader. It says the court turned down all 22 challenges raised by Addison's lawyers, just like you said, John. In doing so, he says, it upheld the constitutionality of the state's 1991 death penalty law. So it's kind of like piece by piece, it did make a big statement. Is that right, John? You're the lawyer, so.
Yeah, absolutely. It did make a big statement. And, you know, what was striking to me, for example, is there is a lot of debate out there about how to approach the question of the constitutionality of the death penalty. Of course, if one takes an originalist perspective, if one asks the question whether the constitutionality of a measure depends on whether it was understood to be constitutional at the point in time that the Constitution was adopted, well, that's an easy question. I mean, it's very, very clear that the adopters of the Constitution contemplated a death penalty. But there are lots of interesting constitutional arguments out there in favor of a different approach to interpreting the Constitution. The Supreme Court took the more formal originalist approach in this opinion and said, not really a hard question at all. Those who wrote the Constitution understood that the death penalty was going to be administered under it. End of question. That's fine. That's certainly a very, very defensible view of the constitutional issue. But there's a lot more that could be said about that issue.
And in among, Josh Rogers, all these specific issues that were brought up in this case, that some of which John outlined, did the name Kelly Ayotte come up, her role in this case? She was attorney general at the time. Did her role come up? Did her name come up as this was discussed in the broader public? John Graby, you want to talk about that?
Well, even within the opinion, there were a couple of issues. And this goes less to the legality of the death penalty and more to the optics in this particular case. But Kelly Ayotte announced that she was going to be seeking the death penalty in this case. She was the attorney general at the time. She announced within a couple of hours of the crime having been committed that she intended to seek the death penalty. That was controversial. I have heard one former state attorney general say that the decision whether to seek the death penalty is a decision that historically has been arrived at after months of consideration, after there's a lot of facts. There were also emails between her and a political advisor that the defense brought up in the case. So it's actually in the opinion. Legally, it didn't take the defendant anywhere, but it's part of the optics of the Addison case, you know, African-American defendant killing white police officer, that make this a particularly compelling an interesting case
well,
to many.
Certainly, as far as Kelly Ayotte's sort of career arc, this was a very big deal in it. You know, she was attorney general when this crime occurred, and as John said, she immediately said, "We're going to seek the death penalty." She also made the decision to put herself front and center, arguing it, which is not necessarily how things always work. There, she was part of the team that argued it. She handled some of the closing arguments. And she featured the death penalty prosecution in her ads when she ran for U.S. Senate. The defense, as John said, did point to emails between her and Rob Varsalone, who's a Republican consultant, where it was mentioned while they were emailing about he was encouraging her to seek office. You know, probably shouldn't use state email for that. And you know, made a joke about, oh, we know where she stands on the death penalty next to the switch. And this was something that was raised by the defense. It was also raised by Paul Hodes you know, to little effect during his campaign against Kelly Ayotte. And, you know, it's her tough on crime persona was certainly something that she featured a lot on the campaign trail. And, you know, she's in Washington. She didn't, you know, yesterday she was, it was interesting to watch her Twitter feed as this opinion came out. She wasn't talking about this. She was, you know, rightfully, I guess, but, you know, many tweets about the failures of so-called Obamacare as this was coming out. And it's you know, it's a long time ago, but this was a big part
of
her.
It's a signature case for her back in the day, so to speak. Let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We want your questions, comments, reactions to the New Hampshire Supreme Court ruling yesterday on the death penalty that we've been talking about. And Kathleen's been waiting in Peterborough. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Laura. Thank you for taking my comment. I'm concerned, I am for the death penalty, but when it's absolutely proven that this person has committed the murder, there's too many times we see 20 years, 30 years later, a person has spent time in jail and it's proven they didn't do it, or they've been killed, and then we find out they didn't really do the crime. So I'm just really concerned about the proof absolutely being there. And another part of this is that I'm concerned about the rights of Officer Briggs. Seems like Michael Addison's rights are far overriding Officer Briggs' rights, even though he's deceased.
Yeah. Kathleen, thank you very much for the comment. And, you know, it's interesting, John, you touched on this earlier, but let's talk about it some more. How has the whole explosion in DNA evidence changed this death penalty debate in this country?
Well,
not just in New Hampshire.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's driven home in the national consciousness that people have been placed on death row and undoubtedly executed in our nation's history who were factually innocent. And, you know, I grew up in Chicago. There is an Innocence Project that has...
That's where it all got started,
that,
right?
That's right. That's been conducted out of Northwestern University that ultimately led the governor of Illinois to commute the sentences of everybody on death row in Illinois. It was an enormously controversial measure. Now, there's no doubt that Addison pulled the trigger and killed Officer Briggs in this case. I mean, they admitted that. The whole case was about seeking to avoid capital punishment. So this is not a case where whether or not he committed the act that caused death is in any way in controversy. But throughout the country, there are many, many cases where people are sentenced to death based on circumstantial evidence, where they are represented by underfunded and often novice defense lawyers. And, you know, the way that the law has developed, once that adjudication of guilt is entered, once a jury has found guilt and the death sentence has been imposed, it's very, very hard to get that set aside during the appellate process. It's a major factor. And, you know, I think most observers would say that the momentum has actually been in favor of those opposing the death penalty over the last few years. The Supreme Court has issued a couple decisions limiting the availability of the death penalty. You cannot execute minors anymore. You cannot execute people with IQs below a certain level.
The U.S. Supreme Court narrowed
that's
death
right.
penalty
that's
in
right.
recent years.
And it's also taken a look around the world in doing so. Controversially, it has noted that worldwide the death penalty is on the wane and that we're one of a relatively few countries and not countries that we typically like to be associated with in imposing the death penalty as often as we do.
So this DNA project that started in your home state of Illinois has kind of recast people's feelings about it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, I mean, certainly there's been movement politically as well. Maryland recently repealed the death penalty, and there have been a number of states in the past decade or so that have done so. And that's one thing that the anti-death penalty folks locally are pointing to, suggesting that sort of momentum is on their side.
Let's take another call if we could. Kathleen, thanks for that one. And in Wilton, Kathy is on the air with us. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mike, I'm pro-death penalty. However, I think as it stands, it doesn't have enough teeth. My question has to do with the appeal process. What dictates how many appeals they can have and the time frame they can take them in? Is that a constitutional thing, or can they be limited?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Kathy. Thank you very much. She's right, you know, in one sense that the death penalty, there, people say endless appeals, John. Now, they're probably not endless, but there are a lot of them.
There are a lot of them, and that's dictated by constitutional right. The Due Process Clause of the 5th and 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clauses of the 5th and 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution say that the government cannot take life, liberty, or property without due process of law. We understandably require more process when we take life than we do, for example, when we take property. You know, there's a limited amount of process you're entitled to before your car is towed. There's a whole lot of process you're entitled to before the government takes your life. And the procedures that we see on display in this case are a result of the Supreme Court saying that, you know, we have to dot our I's and cross our T's carefully before we take a life. You know, there's a tension here. You do say if you're a supporter of the death penalty, boy, the enormous costs that these generate, you know, they make one ask, is there a shortcut? Could we cut some of this process out? Well, the response to that is if we cut some of this process out, we reduce the likelihood of some of these actually innocent people being able to exonerate themselves. I mean, the fact is that notwithstanding all of this process, all of this expensive process, we still do have actually innocent people on death row and have had that. You know, the process is designed to resist that phenomenon.
But Kathy, our caller is right. There are lots and lots of appeals, and there will be for Mr. Addison.
There's still, yeah, he will still have his right to bring all of his constitutional challenges before a federal court.
Here's an email from Suzanne in Nashua. She says, I understand that this is a moot point in New Hampshire, as the state does not have the facility to carry out the sentence, not a gas chamber or other facility. Thanks, Suzanne, for the email. Josh, is she right?
Well, she's not right that it's a moot point, but she is right that New Hampshire does not have a death chamber or gallows or anything up and running ready to execute somebody. And that was something that's been discussed and would either have to be constructed or, you know, I don't know about the, you know, perhaps John could talk about whether or not sending somebody to another state for execution would be a grounds for some sort of legal resistance on the part of the defendant. But she is right that there is no death chamber at the state prison that's ready to go.
Yeah. So kind of waiting, maybe waiting to see what happens with this one particular case. All right, Suzanne, thanks for that email. Kathy, thank you for the call. We'll take a lot more of your comments after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And more of your thoughts, questions, and comments after a short break.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Supreme Court hears arguments about prayers at government meetings. Then best-selling novelist Frederick Forsyth on his latest thriller, The Kill List. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from AARP, offering educational sessions and communities statewide on the new health insurance marketplace and what it means for you and your family. Information at healthlawanswers.org. And the Palace Theater in Manchester presenting Monty Python's Spamalot and the musical that raised silliness to an art form, now through November 16th. Tickets at palacetheater.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can email us your thoughts about the top stories of the week at exchange@nhpr.org or comment on our Facebook page, one word, NHPR Exchange. And be sure to join us for the News Roundup tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the state Supreme Court's ruling just yesterday on the death penalty case of Michael Addison. If you've heard about this case and have questions, thoughts, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us now on the phone is Charlie Putnam. He's Clinical Associate Professor of Justice Studies and Co-Director of Justice Works at UNH, and he's been a supporter of the death penalty. Charlie Putnam, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning to your guests and your listeners.
Well, and we spoke early with Rennie Cushing, who's been a longtime opponent of the death penalty, getting his reaction to the decision yesterday. How about you, Charlie? What did you think?
Well, like Rennie, I served on the on Governor Lynch's commission to look at the death penalty back in 2009, 2010, and I think that that commission had a very robust discussion of the death penalty. Obviously, Rennie and I came to different conclusions about sustaining the death penalty here in New Hampshire, but I think both Rennie and I see it as this is one more milestone on a very long road, and I think both his comments, echo what I would point out, which is that this is a very, very painstaking process, from the investigation to the decisions and the presentation of the prosecution, from the really excellent defense that Mr. Addison got. I can't say enough about the quality of the men and women who worked on the case from his side, to the care and effort that the trial court and the jury put in over weeks and weeks and weeks, the number of issues that the trial court considered carefully, made careful rulings on, both from the bench and from kind of written arguments that she made written rulings on, all the way up to our New Hampshire Supreme Court. There's been a lot of care put into this to make sure that the right person was convicted and that the right sentence was meted out.
Well, and speaking of all that hard work and effort that you mentioned, Charlie, it's also been pointed out this hour that this case has been pretty expensive for the state of New Hampshire, $5 million, and it's not over yet. From your perspective, is it worth that $5
million? Well, I think so. I think that ultimately, my view on the death penalty is that it comes back to what the democracy thinks about it, and that's going to happen again in the legislature. The legislature in our state has considered this issue many, many times over the last 10, 12 years, and it sounds like it's going to consider it again, and that's probably the right thing from the Democratic perspective. And in a democracy, we make a lot of choices about how to spend our money. You know, $5 million, you allocate that over the 6 or 7 years since the killing of Officer Briggs, on an annualized basis, that's still a lot of money, but the state government spends a lot of money, and less than $1 million a year is, I don't want to say it's a drop in the bucket, but the state makes a lot of choices about where to spend its money and how to express the views of the people of this state in the way that it chooses to spend money. So I see the cost as a necessary part. If we believe that the death penalty is appropriate, we must provide the kind of careful procedures that have been described this morning by your guests. And ultimately, the voters and our legislators will make a choice on whether that's a good decision or a bad decision.
Well, and Charlie, you're a legal guy, but I want to ask you a political question, if I could. What do you think this ruling means for the upcoming effort in the legislature to repeal the death penalty, given that the court basically said it was comfortable with the law as it stands?
Thanks for the question. I'm going to dodge just a little bit, Laura, just because I am a legal guy and not a political guy, and I don't serve in the legislature, so I would not want to either take something away from the legislative debate or inject something that's not a fair consideration. I think that both sides will point to this decision and point to the consequences of this decision in making their case to the legislature. And I guess the way I look at it is that our state is changing politically in the last 10, 15, 25 years, and generally voter attitudes towards this particular penalty are changing, and we don't know yet where they'll come to rest. I think it's interesting that in the wake of the home invasion homicides, that the legislature, fairly easily mustered the votes to expand the scope of the death penalty. And although I favor a very limited scope of reserving the death penalty for the worst of the worst, I think that there's still some volatility in public attitudes towards this sentence.
So what is there, Charlie, in this decision by the court that just came out for these both sides in the legislature? You said that you think there's something there for both sides. What is that? I'm curious.
Sure. I think from the I think Mr. Cushing, already has pointed to some of the arguments that he'll make in terms of the cost, in terms of how he views the morality of this sentence or of the death penalty in general. I think the proponents will point to the fact that this is a very careful process that's well-grounded in our history and tradition, and that here in New Hampshire, we are not Texas, we are not Louisiana, we are not Florida, and the efforts to make the debate here in New Hampshire about those other states is really, I think, a failed effort. I think that over and over again, the men and women who work in the criminal justice system on both sides of these cases, defense attorneys as well as prosecutors, as well as jurors, as well as judges, take this process very, very seriously and work incredibly hard to flesh out the ideals of justice for all. And I think that the proponents of the death penalty will point to this decision to say, see how careful this process is.
All right. Charlie, thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Charlie Putnam, Clinical Associate Professor of Justice Studies, Co-Director of Justice Works at UNH. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. By the way, we have put an abbreviated timeline of the history of New Hampshire's death penalty on our webpage, nhpr.org. So if you want a little bit of the background on how New Hampshire has gone around on this issue, nhpr.org. Check out the timeline that we've put there. Josh Rogers, John Graby, let's go right back to our callers. And Virginia's in Concord. Hi, Virginia. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I apologize for the GPS, because it may be heard in the background.
Okay, go ahead. No problem.
I just wanted to say I had my father was killed years ago, and I think my position on this is, having been through it, I also knew the family of the person that killed him. And at the time they were going to seek the death penalty, they told us they were, because my father was a public figure. And I remember thinking at the time, what's the point? It's just going to put them through more hell than they'd already been through. And he was going to die in prison. He was old enough so that he was going to die in prison. And I guess from my perspective, I think it really is an individual family thing. I didn't really want to see his family suffer for what he had done. And I think that it's never as cut and dry. I mean, there was no doubt that he killed him. And there was no doubt in anyone's mind that it was wrong, but there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more people suffering than just the person that did the shooting.
Yeah, Virginia. First of all, very sorry about your loss. What a horrible thing. And second of all, thank you for calling. And John Graby, I guess the question for me that comes out of Virginia's comment is the wishes of the victims. Rennie Cushing's father was murdered. Virginia's father was murdered. How, if at all, how do victims' wishes play in these sentencing decisions? Do they matter at all, or does the court say, this is the process, and thank you very much?
Well, there's a real tension there. One of the arguments in this case was about the introduction of victim impact evidence and the extent to which that might sway the jury in a prejudicial way. And that's a very, very common argument in death penalty cases. It goes to what is the purpose of taking the revenge away from the private individual and transferring it to the state, and what is the ultimate purpose of criminal prosecution? Is it about retribution, or is it simply about deterrence? Like most of the issues that are discussed in the context of this debate, there's no unanimity. There are people on both sides of the issue. So there are people who would say that the families' wishes ought to be part of the calculus, and there are others that say no, this is a public offense, and the decision making should be transferred to the state.
All right, Virginia, thanks for calling. And up next is David in Hopkinton. Hi, David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine.
Great. Great show. I've been trying to. I've heard these a couple of times. I've been trying to get on. I had a cousin who was brutally raped, murdered. The guy brutally raped five. One was a 5-year-old girl who survived. Three died.
Yikes!
He got three death penalties in Pennsylvania about 12 years ago. They caught him red-handed. There's no doubt. Okay. He has now got his own website. He's got girls wanting to marry him. He has a TV. He's adapted to prison life. He's claiming that he was beaten as a child and all this. And I would like to see him dead. I don't care if it deters crime. He'll never do it again. But what I don't want is 40, 50 years from now when he's an old man, he's an old man. He can't hurt anybody. We'll let him out. I don't want that. I want him, if I am promised that he will never, ever get out of prison, that would be fine with me. But what I worry about is, you know, down the road, he gets out.
Yeah, there's a skepticism there,
he's
David.
In a wheelchair or whatever.
Yeah. You know? And David, wow, what a story. And again, my same feelings that I expressed to Virginia. That's terrible for you and, of course, the victims. What do you think, John Grabe? There is a public skepticism that the death penalty isn't, or that this life in prison, excuse me, isn't real. We say it, but we don't really do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, you know, we certainly, it varies from state to state and from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I mean, there is a sentence of life without the possibility of parole that has become, you know, pervasive in cases where there is, you know, where the state seeks the death penalty and, you know, ultimately that doesn't happen. And but it's a matter of political will. And, you know, as you talked about, cost really drives the penal debates. And as we have more and more people in prison, as we have an aging prison population, as we have to provide health care, as people live longer and longer, pressures do rise on states to, you know, consider release.
We talked about that a couple weeks ago in the exchange. Aging prison population. David, thank you very much for the call. And Josh Rogers, to you as we close out, you know, just once again, wrap this up for us, if you could, please, in terms of what this whole thing means for the upcoming death penalty repeal bill in the legislature.
Well, we'll find out. As Charlie was saying earlier, there are things in this opinion that both sides will point to. Certainly proponents of the status quo would say, you know, this was due process and Mr. Addison was well represented and it works here in New Hampshire. And, you know, critics, I think, increasingly are going to point to the cost of administering this penalty. And, you know, this debate will be interesting. It's a bipartisan bill. As Representative Cushing said, he's one sponsor. Republican Steve Valancourt is another. There are some Republicans. It's, you know, it's a diverse coalition of people on both sides of the political spectrum and folks in the middle, and they're going to be mounting a big PR push. You know, we've already started to hear the repetition of the phrase, New Hampshire can live without the death penalty. Representative Cushing said it today. We're going to be hearing more about that, and it'll be interesting to watch Governor Hassan. And, you know, this is going to be one of the more high-profile debates of the second year of the legislative session.
Yeah, because the dynamic has changed, having a governor for the first time, as you said, in many, many years that does not favor the death penalty. Here's a quick email that came in. This is something that you mentioned earlier, Josh, so I'll throw it to you. Jill in Enfield says, why are they seeking the death penalty in this case? Is it because he's a police officer? Jill says there are many violent and malicious crimes where the death penalty has not been sought. So I was just curious what criteria are used, or is it that it's just a high-profile case? You touched on this earlier, Josh, but this has to do with the law.
In the line of duty, Officer Briggs was out. There was a domestic disturbance call. He confronted Mr. Addison, asked him to stop. Mr. Addison turned and shot. Officer Briggs was on duty. It fits the statute.
Yeah, the statute, again, maybe Jill missed that part. The statute has six or seven specific crimes.
Murder for hire, law enforcement, during a rape, during a kidnapping, during a commission of some drug crimes, home invasion, and murder by a convict already serving life in prison without parole.
Yeah. Jill, it's a good question. I hope that answers it for you. And last question for you, John Grabe. So we've talked a lot about the big issues and the bill that will be debated when the legislative session opens. What's the next step for Michael Addison's team in this case? I mean, as you said at the outset, there's one more question that the state Supreme Court has to weigh in on.
Yeah, there's a question under the statute. They are supposed to consider whether the application of the death penalty in this situation is excessive or disproportionate. That raises a vexing issue because we have not had the death penalty administered in this state since 1939. So what do we compare this to? The Supreme Court a couple of years ago accepted the argument that they need to look outside the state. And so there needs to be an investigation done of circumstances in other states where
because we haven't had really a lot of these cases.
That's right. There's nothing to compare. And so the court has said that it's going to conduct that investigation and hear argument and receive briefs on that. That is an issue that remains on direct appeal. Once the Supreme Court decides that issue, and if the Supreme Court rejects the argument that application of the death penalty here would be disproportionate, then we get into what is called the collateral review stage, where claims that have already been made to the state Supreme Court can be pressed by means of a writ of habeas corpus. The eventual destination is going to be federal court, where a federal judge and then ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court will evaluate whether Addison's conviction and sentence comply with the United States Constitution.
You have to tell me what habeas corpus is because I forget.
Habeas corpus is Latin for you have the body. It's an ancient writ, and it's basically a claim that you are being held or that you're under a constraint that is unconstitutional.
Okay. Both of you, thank you very much for clearing some of this up for us. I really appreciate it. Josh Rogers, thank you for taking the time.
Oh, you're welcome, Mara.
Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. John Grabe, great to see you as always. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
John Grabe, professor at UNH School of Law, specializing in constitutional law. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are John Barrett and Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The New Hampshire Supreme Court rules on the state's only death penalty case, largely upholding the conviction. The state legislature opens a special session to decide Medicaid expansion. And cities around the Granite State held elections this week, with voters stating their preferences for mayor, council, and other local offices. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next to 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Birches at Concord, a benchmark senior living community, hosting Dr. Robert Santulli November 12th, discussing and signing his book, The Alzheimer's Family, Helping Caregivers Cope, details at 224-9111. And from Holy Rosary Credit Union, with public access to branches and ATMs nationwide, more information online at hrcu.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The public prayer issue is back in the U.S. Supreme Court. 30 years ago, the court settled a case in Nebraska, ruling then that the state legislature could open sessions with an invocation. Prayers are now common in public settings across the country, but yesterday the justices took up a